I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 138 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week wrote, sang, and played lead guitar on many of the Bangles' best songs, Vicki Peterson. She was the most prolific songwriter in a band that kept having hits that they didn't write. That was kind of a weird dynamic. I'll just note that when I fell hard for the Bangles upon the release of their 1984 debut album, All Over the Place, it was on the basis of its originals, and Peterson wrote or co-wrote all nine of them. The co-writes with fellow singer-guitarist Susanna Hoffs include Hero Takes a Fall, Dover Beach, and Restless. The songs on which Peterson was a sole writer include James, All About You, He's Got a Secret, and More Than Meets the Eye. Though Hoffs wound up singing lead on two of those, Peterson explains how that happened. The covers versus originals tension was on greater display on the breakthrough second album, 1986's Different Light. It opens with the heavily produced Prince-written single, Manic Monday, before Peterson's guitar kicks in and the band sounds like the Bangles of old on In a Different Light. But it was the songs from outside writers, especially Liam Sternberg's Walk Like an Egyptian, that made the Bangles famous, with Hoffs often in the spotlight. By their third album, 1988's Everything, the band members were collaborating with outside writers more than each other, and the smash hit Eternal Flame sounded miles away from Hero Takes a Fall. There wouldn't be a fourth Bangles album for 15 years.
Close your eyes, give me your hand.
Peterson takes us through the band's formation, the enlisting of her younger sister Debbie, a previous Caro Pop guest, on drums, and the additions of Hoffs and, after the first EP, bassist Michael Steele. She gets into pressures from the record label and producer David Kahn, plus tensions and conflicting agendas that culminated in a painful Bangles breakup meeting. It's worth noting that there is no Vicki Peterson solo album, at least not yet. She has been a band person through and through. And after the Bangles implosion, she joined the Continental Drifters, an all-star collective that included former Caro Pop guest Peter Holsapple of the DBs, Susan Cousel, Mark Walton, and others. Peterson and Susan Cousel also performed together for years as the Psycho Sisters and released an album, Up on the Chair, Beatrice, in 2014. Vicki Peterson is married to John Cousel, Susan's brother, who also drums with her, including in the band Action Skulls with Billy Mummy. Does Peterson especially like making music with family members? How did she enjoy touring with the Go-Go's as the fill-in guitarist? Does she foresee the Bangles performing or recording together again? What is her creative life like now? No surprise, Vicki Peterson is smart, revealing, and down-to-earth, and she reflects on a brilliant musical career. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Vicki Peterson.
I'm finding out all about you.
Thank you for doing this. I really do appreciate it. It's really good to talk to you. I went to Penn and you guys played at Irvine Auditorium, I think the next year after, like March of, I looked it up, March of 86.
86, yes.
So, yeah. And I remember you, guys covering Seven and Seven Is.
Yes.
So, and I was into Love then. So I thought, oh, that's cool.
Because
I didn't think anyone else
there
knew that.
Go.
So,
yes, that was one of those bands that when Debbie and I first met Susanna and she knew who Arthur Lee and Love were, and she knew, and she was a Paul Revere and the Raiders fan, but she was also, into the Stones and the Beatles and Patti Smith and Television. So she had, it was interesting for me to find somebody who respected and loved Arthur Lee and Love as well, because I did as well. That album, for whatever reason, that reminds me more of the 80s than it, because I wasn't conscious enough in the 60s to be all over that, but it's a great record.
Forever Changes was like, whoa, what is this record?
Right?
It's just kind of like feels like a niche that no other record ever has. Like, and I listen to it all the time. I had Johnny Eccles on. I talked to him.
Seriously?
And that was amazing. And then I just had Bruce Botnick, who produced Forever Changes. And mm-hmm. We were talking mostly about the Doors because he had all this Door stuff that came out. But I'm like, you have to tell me about working on Forever Changes and, what was going on in the band and why were they not on two of the songs and all of that stuff. But
yeah, that must have been interesting. The Brian versus Arthur stuff. And yeah.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about was, like, you came into this and you were a songwriter and singer and guitarist before you formed the Bangles.
Mm-hmm.
Did you always envision yourself as being a band person versus a solo person? Because almost everything you've done has been in collaboration with people, as opposed to here I am, look at me.
No, I describe myself as a serial band member. I've just from day one, although I was playing guitar and writing songs alone as a 9-year-old, 10-year-old. But by the time I was 15, 16, I had connected with my best friend in high school, Amanda. And it was like, let's be in a band. Let's be the female Simon and Garfunkel. And then let's be, you know, we went from there to forming a band with our friends. And it was the classic high school band. You're in band with friends, and it's not so much based on people's musical ability. It's just more fun and hanging out and playing songs you like. And, but we went from there straight to playing clubs. And when I was at UCLA, we were booking shows and playing clubs all through the early 80s, late 70s and early 80s. And then my partner, Amanda, left to pursue a history degree and another whole different lifestyle. And so Debbie and I were left. And that's when we met Susanna and we started the Bangs.
Right. And with Debbie, who's your little sister, at what point did you think, oh, I want her in the band?
I didn't. I was an idiot that way. But I just did. It never occurred to me that she was who she was as a musician. Because, you know, I had an older sister, Pam, and our older sister was sort of she was the musical guru in certain ways. She had the record collection. She had the Arthur Lee and Love records. She had the, you know, Dave Clark 5 records. She kind of set the musical tone in the house. And so I was more paired up with her. And then my younger siblings, Debbie and our baby brother, Dave, who's another incredible musician and engineer, sound engineer. They were the babies, you know, so they were sort of over there because we're all about 2.5 years apart, but it's sort of, as families do, we were sort of bifurcated. And right. The girls and the babies. So Debbie wasn't even really on my radar. I wasn't paying attention to how closely she was paying attention. She was paying attention to everything I did. We shared a room because I never had my own room. We shared our room, a room together. And so music was always playing. And I would notice that she was a very adept air bass player, air drummer, air guitar player. She would absolutely mime the parts. And she was listening actually in a way more carefully than I was to records. And so when it came time to look for a drummer, we had had a couple guys play with us. We had one woman come and audition for us at one point, but she was driving from way out of town and she was a little older than we were. I think she was 20. Oh my God. So it was like, that wasn't going to work. So It was actually my friend Amanda who said, well, why don't we try Debbie? And I was like, what are you talking about? You know, I was not paying attention, as I say. But we sat her down at a drum kit and she was an absolute natural from day one.
And she hadn't sat at a drum kit before?
She had not.
So Amanda just was like, let's try your sister who's never drummed as our drummer.
She was, like I said, she was probably watching a little better than I. And didn't have this sort of preconceived notion of, you know, Debbie as a child and not a human being and a musician.
Right.
And I'm giving Debbie tons of credit here because she's very, very tolerant of all this. And plus, Debbie was starting to hang around a little bit more. So we were kind of just spending time with her and stuff. And so it was just sort of like, yeah, well, let's see. And we did it publicly. We did it with some friends of ours who were in a proper grown-up cover band. You know, they worked all the time playing, not so much clubs, but events and schools and that sort of things. They were a cover band. Unlike us, we were sort of somewhere in the middle between a band trying to write original material and then doing really kind of horrific versions of cover songs. And, but we went to their rehearsal space and they were kind enough to take a break and then sit Debbie down at a kit and say, okay. And the drummer of that band just kind of gave her the whole, like, you know, we'll do this. And she goes, and he just, like, it was, like I said, it was just an instant. And then we played a song with her. And then it was just like, okay, you're in.
Do you remember what the song was?
Yes, it was Heat Wave.
Oh, the Martha
Yeah,
Mandels?
Martha Mandels, yeah.
Nice. When you were growing up, would your family, like, sing songs around the piano or the guitar? Would you harmonize with each other?
We were in the car. We were in the Buick station wagon, and that was where the harmonies happened. And like I said, our older sister, she would get the shotgun seat because she would call it first. And so she got to control the radio. But Debbie and I were sitting in the back of the station wagon, would be singing along. And we always, for whatever reason, gravitated to the background harmonies. And we would naturally kind of split up. Or I'm going to go for the high, you go for the middle. Okay. And without discussing it. And so that was sort of a natural inclination for us for some reason. And I mean, I knew all the lyrics to these songs, but loved singing the harmonies.
When you started writing songs, were you thinking of harmonies right off the bat?
Not in the earliest of days. I was sort of writing cringeworthy sort of Joni Mitchell, you know, emotional teenage girl songs.
Do you remember the first song you wrote?
Yes, I think it was called "I Think It's Love." And wow. The chords were E, A, and D.
Solid chords. Those are, you know, well-established changes there.
Nope, there's three of them. And that's.
What was the earliest song that you wrote that you thought, wait a minute, this one's really good?
Oh, God. That wasn't until later. I was pretty critical and rightly so of the early stuff. I was writing some songs in around 17, 18 years old, 19, that started to become pretty good. I wrote the beginnings of what became He's Got a Secret and James, both around that age. And so I knew that those were pretty solid songs.
What was your routine in writing then? Would you come up with lyrics and then pick up a guitar and figure out the chords, or would you just kind of strum and then whatever came out was the song?
Yes.
The latter.
D, all of the above. Normally I would start with a guitar, but I usually had a sort of a lyric idea or a title or just a song idea, if not an actual lyric. And but the guitar would be in my hands and I would come up with a change, usually something more interesting than AED, but not always. a riff perhaps. And then it would go from there. But I was actually writing way more regularly than I do now, unfortunately, because just your life is not quite so distracted. And, you know, occasionally I'd get the comment from my dad that, you know, what are you doing in here? You know, your mother was doing dishes. You should go help your mother, you know, instead of sitting in here wasting your time playing guitar. And there was a little of that.
When you would write something like James, would there be a real James in your mind, or was James a character that you want to write a song about?
James was a character, but it was based on a true story. It was based on my college roommate who was having a probably now would be called a non-politically correct affair with her professor. So, so I sort of took the situation that was actually happening and created a story.
When did you realize that things clicked musically with you and Susanna?
The first day we met. Debbie and I drove away from her house and we lived in Hollywood. Susanna lived in Brentwood and we, you know, it was quite a schlep. So driving there, we're like, what are we doing? This is the weirdest thing. I've talked to this person on the phone one time and we're meeting and we'll just see what happens. And we talked, we sat down, we played some music. She played me a cassette of something she had done. We played her cassettes of things we had done. And we sang together. And that was the clincher for me. When Debbie and Suzanne and I sang together and I heard what happened with the blend of our voices. And then also talking to her, like, what are you looking for? What do you want to do? And she was, you know, like, yeah, everything. I want it all. I want world domination. And so we drove away saying, okay, we have a band again, you know, we have a new.
She answered an ad. Was that it?
She called an ad that had been replaced by our housemate who we had just fired from our group. She was our lead guitar player. And so as my friend Amanda went off to get her history degree, we fired the guitar player. And so it was just down to Debbie and me. And so, Lynn, a guitar player, had put an ad in The Recycler, which some of your listeners might know is was a pre-Craigslist, pre-internet place where you would advertise everything from a refrigerator to a bass player. And Susanna was looking for people to play with. And so she saw Lynn's ad, and she called the apartment looking for Lynn, who was not there.
Right. You stole her.
I did, but I was ethical about it, because after talking with Susanna for about an hour and a half, the first time we connected on the phone, I said, okay, well, I know you called to talk to Lynn, so I'll give Lynn your message, and, you know, and you guys can have your conversation, which they did. And I asked Lynn, you know, it's like, what, so what do you think? And she's like, yeah, I don't think, she, I don't know. I don't really feel it. I don't think she's right. And we're like, okay, good.
How specific was the ad, by the way? Was it like someone who likes television and love, or?
No, that it would have been.
You didn't even place the ad.
I didn't write it. If I had written it, yes, absolutely. But no, I think she was just looking for a, you know, another guitar player, to start a band with. Lynn was, and her musical loves right then were pretty much the Stones and Tom Petty, which, you know, still fits into our musical vision for sure. But that was really where, that was the lane Lynn was working in.
Do you remember the first song you wrote with Sue?
It might've been Tell Me or Call on Me. Yeah. It was in that group of songs.
And so how did those collaborations work? Would you sit there with guitars and just come up with it, or mm-hmm. one of you bring in part of a song usually, and have yeah. the other one finish it, or?
At that point we were sitting in, her apartment garage and, garage apartment. And, would just have an idea. Often it was a musical idea or a rhythmic idea. You know, Call on Me was very Beatles. Tell Me was more sort of Stones. I don't know. We would come up with, musical touchstones to, you know, to grab onto.
And then what was the playing out like? Like, what was the scene like when you started, you know, playing clubs and all of that?
Well, first of all, we had to find a bass player, and that wasn't super easy. But we did find Annette Zielinskas. Oddly enough, it's sort of one of those foreshadowing things. I remember Susanna asked a friend of hers, so who's the best female bass player in LA? And the answer was Michael Steele, or Mickey Steele. And Sue had called her, and Mickey was like, I want nothing to do with an all-girl band. She had runaway PTSD.
Right.
She had been runaways very briefly. And so she was not interested at all in being in an all-female band. Understandable. So that was put aside. And we found Annette through ads in the paper. And she was just couldn't have been sweeter and more, you know, willing to learn and willing to play and just lovely. So we just started playing. The first few shows we played were with like punk rock bands, and just of course bottom of the bill for the most part, and but having a great time, having a blast.
From the start, were you like, the Bangs were an all female band, it's important that we're doing that?
Yes. Yeah. I think it just felt, you know, I had had experience playing with mixed gender bands, and it just never worked for me. And there was always complications, and are usually my fault, because the man in our band was my boyfriend in high school. So it was, it just always got complicated. And so didn't want that. Or straight women being in a band with other straight women, you're probably going to have less of those kinds of complications. It was important because it just felt more unified, and it felt more like that feeling of like, we're in a gang, you know, we're in a gang, we're in a club. And it was the, you know, no boys allowed club at that point.
You know, and did you look at bands like, you know, the Runaways or the Go-Go's as sort of like feeling like, okay, they've made it a little bit easier for us? Or did you still, you know, bang your head against a lot of, you know, sexism? Basically.
Oh, no, of course there was still tons of that. You have to understand, we're like, ratio wise, we're in the tiniest little increment of collections of bands in Los Angeles. The Runaways for me were, they didn't count, because for, as far as I was concerned, they were put together by a man. They were,
right.
You know, a whole different thing. It wasn't until, you know, years later that I, you know, developed a ton of respect for, you know, Joan and Lita and, you know, Jackie and Sandy and, the original members, especially, I did not like how that developed. That was exactly what everything I was working against was to be formed by somebody else's idea of what we're supposed to be. and especially a man who's trying to hypersexualize you and that sort of thing was exactly what I did not want and fought against over and over and over again. And the Go-Go's were very much a part of what was happening in LA right then, but they had gone to London around the time that the Bangs first started to play. So they weren't around. And I would ask friends, you know, so do you think people would just, are just going to compare us to the Go-Go's the whole time? And they said, oh no, you're completely different. You're a completely different band. You're a different market. You're a different, this is even before the Bangs, when my band with Amanda and Debbie were playing clubs, you know, and we were very much, we were all like a power pop band actually. So it was a very different aesthetic. So, but yes, of course, the Go-Go's have to get credit for making it clear to the corporate world that this business model works, you know, that you, it's okay to sign a quote unquote all girl band and you're going to, you know, you'll, you might make some money. So that, that was helpful to us in the end for sure.
Yeah. I didn't equate musically, at least I didn't equate the two bands. You know, you guys came more from kind of where I was living, you know, in terms of my, you know, like 60s file, Beatle-y, you know, 3 minute perfect pop song. I mean, All Over the Place is just one after the other of those. It's like this sort of like rubber soul for the 80s, you know, like I really, like at the time, like that was really how I reacted to it. And I didn't think like, oh, it's like a female. I was just like, no, this is just like rubber soul for the 80s. And the Go-Go's I really liked too. And I liked, the Specials, and you know, they've been on the Specials record. And so it, but it just came from a slightly different place, but obviously both bands also, you know, had image makers who were trying to give you guys visual makeovers, which, you know, a band like REM, I don't think had to deal with.
Exactly. I know. So, I would use REM as my like the comparison, the control group, you know, like, well, they didn't have to deal with that. And they got to, you know, speak together as a group and, you know, fight against their label if they had to and that sort of thing.
Well, yeah, and like the early videos you guys are wearing, I mean, and I don't know whether you were being outfitted for those as well, but it seemed more like you were, it was not glammed up. It was like, hey, we're just kind of these boho, I don't know what, I'm going to use some wrong terms, but it was, you were not dressed up. You were more dressed down and just kind of looked like regular people. And then later that it just seemed like the image stuff got pumped up. And I don't know how much of that was, you know, you guys seem like, oh, we're on a bigger stage now. We have to be more conscious versus it being imposed on you.
That's so interesting that you say Hero Takes a Fall, because that was our first, Columbia video that we had made. Before that, we had made a video from the EP Real World.
Real World,
and that,
yeah.
That was one we made completely ourselves with friends. And in those videos, we're wearing our thrift shop, normal thrift shop clothes that we, you know, couldn't, there was no wardrobe budget. There was just what you had. And then, so with Hero Takes a Fall, that was our first experience with a label trying to quote unquote dress us up or style us. And I find it mildly horrifying what we ended up wearing in that video. And that was not, to me, regular people stuff. That was very, that's very much cliched 80s. Sort of ironically, after Hero Takes a Fall, we said, okay, well, no more of that. And so the next video, that the next big video that we did, either going down to Liverpool or Manic Monday, we're wearing our own clothes. Again.
There you go.
Yeah.
You know the Scott Miller quote about you guys from his What Music What Happened book?
Uh-oh.
By the way? No. He's in that book, which you've like, you have to pay like hundreds of dollars to find now, but I have one. Scott Miller from Game Theory, who I also got really into at that time.
Yes, absolutely.
He said that he called The Real World one of the top songs of the 1980s and wrote about the EP. Those who know only Eternal Flame might be amazed at how inventive and together they were in their relative infancy.
Aw, thank you, Scott. Yeah, I mean, the people who, again, and it's the majority, I guess, probably now, is the people who know Eternal Flame or Walk Like an Egyptian, you know, you don't know anything about the Bengals. That's just the truth. You just don't.
Well, if those got you to go back to the other records, then you're all right.
But yeah, absolutely. You know, please go dig deep.
So in All Over the Place, you worked with David Kahn. Mm-hmm. What was sort of the tug of war on, you know, dealing with the sort of studio interests on that record versus what you guys wanted to sound like?
It was a struggle on that one. It was a struggle on all of them, actually, to be honest, with David Kahn. But it was our first major studio experience. We had recorded the EP with Craig Leon. We did it in, you know, like 3 days, very quickly. All over the place, of course. Now we're on a major label and there's a major budget and there's money involved. David Kahn's under incredible pressure to deliver something, which of course, that's not what you want to be aware of when you're trying to make a record, but
right.
It was there. He's also trying to figure out who we are and what we can do and what we can't do in his mind. And he's very, very particular, you know, very, very, very intelligent man, but also somebody who does not have the best bedside manner. We're not the only band he's made cry. And yet, as far as the studio went, I think we learned a lot from him. And he did a lot. He made a lot of really wonderful choices. But then also, you know, I felt like I was fighting him a lot. I fought tooth and nail for real strings on More Than Meets the Eye. He did a synth version, and it was not going to work for me. And so I just said, I just really do not want synth. It just went against every fiber of my being at that moment to have that sound on a record.
Right. It's such a not synth record too.
Exactly. It was very organic. There was nothing that wasn't pretty much created by, you know, our eight hands. So it did not work for me. So I fought him on it, and he didn't, obviously, you know, he's thinking bottom line, he's thinking budget. And but luckily, I think for the song and for the record, I prevailed. And he and Jimmy Haskell did a beautiful string arrangement for that song.
Otherwise, arranging wise, were you pretty much left alone or?
Yeah. I mean, it started with us. He would have, he would have input. There was something that he felt like these two songs have the grooves are too similar on this. You know, they both sound like cowpunk songs was one thing he always sort of accused us as.
What was that? Tell me?
The beat on Tell Me, the boom, chick, boom, doom, doom.
Right. Well, that's the closest I could think of. I never would have thought of it as cowpunk, but when you said that, it's the only one I could think of. Yeah. What else is cowpunk on that record?
There isn't now.
It's a cowpunk record.
Hey.
It's a stealth cowpunk.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, he encouraged Susanna and me actually to think rhythmically a little bit more expansively on that record in certain places. I mean, James used to be almost a reggae beat and it changed.
James is one that you wrote and Susanna sings. Is that, did you sing it originally? Like, how did that decision happen?
I did. I'd already been singing it for about 2 years with Amanda and Debbie and Lynn in that band. We'd been performing it for a while. It went a couple of ways. One was that it wasn't that I was tired of singing it, but I felt like she was bringing a freshness to it. But also, to be perfectly honest, I mean, Kahn just made no secret of the fact that he preferred her voice pretty much over everything else. So it would be like, you have to say, fuck you. No, man, I'm singing it. It's my song. I'm singing it, whatever. You know, if I wasn't ready to do that. And I wasn't, cause I was like, well, you try it. And it was like, well, she sounds great. Sounds great. Yeah, go for it. I mean, the same with He's Got a Secret.
So she hadn't been singing that live before guys were in the studio.
Not at all.
Then He's Got a Secret were both. Okay. Mm-hmm,
same thing. Yeah.
And then Dover Beach, I think you guys co-wrote.
We definitely co-wrote that one. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a good one.
Thank you. I like that one too. It was fun.
And you had your Going Down to Liverpool, which was a great cover. And I knew Katrina and the Waves a little bit because I think they just had those Canadian records at the time. So
we didn't know them at all actually yet. I'd heard the Kimberly Rue version of Going Down to Liverpool, not the Katrina and the Waves. He did a demo and it was brought to us by my housemate, Spock Dean, who unfortunately just left the planet a matter of weeks ago. But she's the one who brought the song to my attention anyway. And said, this is a Kimberly Rue song. You got it. This is a great song. You guys should do it. And luckily, she was also working at CBS at that time. So it made it to David Kahn's office, too. So he agreed.
And you guys introduced me to Emmett Rhodes on that record, too.
There you go. Emmett Rhodes. That he was shoot, I mean, back in my high school, I rediscovered his first solo record. I always knew the merry-go-round. I loved She's a Lovely Woman. I loved Liv. But he had a solo record called Fresh as a Daisy. And I didn't discover it until probably late 70s, mid 70s when I was in high school. And I just loved it because it's very Beatlesque. It's very Paul McCartney,
right.
So Emmett Rhodes was definitely on our hit list for our EP when we were looking and thinking about producers. Actually, we found him, we tracked him down. He was living at his mom's house in, God, I want to say Redondo Beach or somewhere down in the South Bay. And we found him, and he had a little recording studio out in the garage, and wow. He was out there, and we wanted to ask him to produce our record. And, you know, we're these little, you know, 20-year-olds going, can we please, please, please. He had kind of a soured attitude about everything he had done in the past. And I'm sure it was well warranted and in his brain deserved, but to us it was a downer. So we were like, yeah, we don't want somebody who's feeling embittered and sad. We want someone who's happy and up. So
yeah, we came to you because we love your
and past, we love you so. And we love everything that you're talking badly about right now. So yeah, Debbie and I actually sang with him on some recordings in towards the end of his life, actually. And he was trolled. He didn't seem to me as quite as heavy spirited, but he still had that. I don't know exactly what that was, that sort of heavy karma about him.
Mm. You go into record all over the place. It's your debut album. It came out, you guys toured, you guys got reviewed and all that. Did you get out of that experience what you hoped to? And was that like a good thing overall, the way that went
that down? Album?
Yeah. I mean, and just experience around that album. I mean, again, from the outside, for me as a listener, I'm like, that's great. Can't wait to hear the next one. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what it felt like for you guys.
Well, I don't want to go all Emmett Rhodes on you, but I remember I was dating Jeff McDonald from Red Cross at the time. And I remember coming back to him after a night of, we were just wrapping things up. And I remember thinking, I don't know how anyone ever makes a second record. I just don't. I felt so drained at that point. And yet, ironically, it is probably the most representative of who the band really was at that moment of all the records that we made subsequently. And ultimately, it is probably one of my favorite ones to listen to.
What was so draining about it?
What was so draining about it?
Yeah.
Again, the feeling that it was a constant struggle. The struggle to try and maintain what you feel is your identity as a band and being a serial band member, I was way more focused on the collective and what is this band going to sound like and what are we going to be bringing into the world here, and struggling against the forces that were looking at it in an entirely different way.
When the album actually came out, were you able to just enjoy it as an album, or were there constant pressure on pumping up the single, doing something commercial, like the pressure? Did the pressure exceed the pleasure in like we're playing these songs that we really like?
Sounds I always like liked playing the songs live, and still to this day, even though we don't all do all that much from all over the place, or Bangles haven't in recent years, but of course we were immediately pushed into promotion mode, and there was no break. You're immediately going out on a 6-week promotional tour. You're going to Europe, not to play shows, but just to do TV and interviews. And then you're going out on a proper, 8-week tour, and then you'll be home for another 10 days. And then you're going out on another tour, and then you're going to be home for 6 weeks. And then we're going back to the studio. It was that kind of,
right.
Like, wow, wait, what, huh? What? So it was that classic. You have your whole life to write your first record and, 2 weeks to write the second.
Was there a lot of micromanagement of how you did those interviews and how you presented yourselves and all of that?
No, we were pretty much left to our devices, I would say.
And how much of Different Light, that album, was written at this point? Or did you really just turn that around really fast?
No, very little. And that was a problem. And it was only a problem in retrospect. It didn't really occur to me at the time how much of a problem it was going to be, but that there was really a time bomb ticking and there was a clock on it. And I didn't realize that. And I think I would have maybe spent a little more energy trying to develop that muscle that allows you to write songs on the road that people like Prince had and other people who were able to just, you know, come back from a show and instead of having a snack and reading a novel and then finally going to sleep, writing a song and recording a demo, you know, and just working that way all the time. And we weren't at that level traveling in any kind of luxury. We didn't have a bus. We were all in a van and together we were sharing rooms. There wasn't a lot of, you know, creative solitude. So for me, that was not it was not conducive to songwriting at all.
Right. Annette had left after the EP. You guys did bring in Michael Steele. So she changed her mind about joining you guys.
She did. Well, she and I ended up being housemates. And she has actually been quoted as saying that it's the one calculated move she'd ever made. She'd seen us play around in town and liked the band. And I remember we were kind of circling her again, too, like, you know, starting to talk to her. Because Annette was making it clear that she wasn't really happy in the band. And she wasn't a strong harmony singer. She really wanted to do more cowpunk. She wanted to do more of that style, rockabilly, and that was really her love. It was absolutely a joint decision for her to move on before we signed with CBS, actually. And so we needed a bass player. And I remember asking Mickey one night, it was an after party show. It was like probably 4 a.m. And I remember saying, if you had your ultimate choice to be in a band, how would you describe that band? And she'd say something like, well, I think it would be the Kinks with Fairport Convention vocals. Hmm. And I'm like, I love that answer.
Yeah.
And then I remember her saying, if I were ever to join your band, do I have to wear plastic miniskirts? Because we had played the whiskey and we had made plastic dresses with like vinyl cutouts and that sort of thing. And I was like, no, you can wear whatever you want. It's fine. Don't worry. She had a very strong fashion sense. She still does. And so luckily what she did is she moved into the house where I was living, the aforementioned Spock Hotel. And it's also where Steve Wynn was living briefly. And so it was a wonderful little creative spot right on Crescent Heights in Los Angeles. And so Mickey was my housemate. And so when it came time to audition bass players, we auditioned a few people, but we just asked Mickey, would you think of playing? And she was a no-brainer, of course.
Did you expect her to write songs at that point too?
I didn't know if she was a writer or not at that point. I knew she could sing.
So she came in before All Over the Place, didn't have any songs on that, mm-hmm. But then wrote... Did she write one? I know she sings September Girls and mm-hmm. Following, is that it?
Following.
On
her original.
Right. What was it like incorporating another songwriter into the group on top of everything else?
She was obviously a strong writer, but she seemed to keep her writer identity apart from Susanna or me. It seemed like she wasn't terribly interested in co-writing, and which made me sad because one of my sort of, again, REM business models was that the band would be the songwriters. It's the Beatles for me.
Right.
It's like John, Paul, and George are the writers. And that very quickly fell apart and during Different Light. And I wish I'd, you know, been able to write more with my bandmates, but it just didn't, they weren't feeling that same thing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, her songs are strong, but they always seemed a little bit more like a satellite around some of the other stuff, like not quite in the center of it, if I'm allowed to say that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess she got the George Harrison treatment in a way. It's like, yes, of course, you can have some songs. But I mean, there was never a hard and fast rule. Like, well, you can only have 1.3 songs on this record, you know. It was never like that. But, you know, but she brought in some really strong songs and some ones that we just had a blast doing, like Glitter Years and, you know.
It's a good one.
Yeah.
So Different Light, you're in a hurry. They reunite you with David Kahn. Mm-hmm. Did you have to sign off on that? Or was that just sort of like, nah, this is what we're doing?
They definitely wanted, I didn't really understand the dynamics that he was a staff producer and they were determined to use him, you know, that was what they wanted to have happen.
Was he like promoted or something too? Like to become like an A&R guy by the second record?
Yeah, he was definitely promoted. But it was also like, then he was getting pressured. We need a hit, but we need a hit now. that was fun. That was nice. That was good. You made a decent record with these girls, you know, who we're not even sure what we think of yet, or we don't know how to market, but now we need a hit. So let's get serious here. As it turned out, well, two things. One was that we weren't sure we wanted to work with David again, because it was divisive, the first record. You know, one of his MOs is divide and conquer, you know, like get everyone kind of in separate corners so you can kind of manipulate a little bit better and get what you need out of what you think you need out of these people.
Yeah, which is the last thing you want when you're trying to be REM.
Exactly. Thank you. And the last thing you want when you're trying to operate as a band and a unit. Right,
exactly.
Yeah.
Like, not that you were trying to be REM, but trying to have that collective identity, yes, all for one sort of mentality.
He did have to sort of woo us back after the second record. He actually was sent to, I remember having a dinner with him in New Orleans. We were playing in New Orleans. I was already there with my family, and I'd gone there a little bit early, and Debbie and I had, and Sue and Mickey and David Kahn flew in for this show, and he knew he had to kind of woo us back. And I remember at this dinner just saying, you know, that there were a lot of things that happened that weren't okay in that studio. And he's like, I know, I get it. I'm listening. I hear you. He was very accommodating. And I just determined to get this. It was like getting a business account for him or something. That's how it felt, you know. But we agreed to, it was sort of the path of least resistance, I guess, to say, okay, all right, we'll try it again. We'll see where we're at. And so the second time around, it was very different. And there were way more outside writers and material being brought in, partially to, you know, I'm sure it was because of that timeline, and we weren't coming up with hit songs hand over fist. So
whatever he sold you, it wasn't what he delivered, it doesn't sound like.
Well, not entirely. I mean, he couldn't be anything other than who he is. And plus, he was going through crazy personal stuff at the time. So a lot of stuff was out of his control. I'm just giving him that, you know, way out as well at that time. But yeah, it was rough. It was, the second album was worse in a lot of ways. But, you know, again, but we were learning as we went. And so there were skills that were being developed. So in some ways, we were getting better about things.
So Prince had seen you guys when you were touring all over the place. Mm-hmm. And that, like, aside from them bringing in stuff, he'd already just given you Manic Monday, or like, basically, how did that work?
Yes. He basically handed over a cassette with Manic Monday on it. And so that was kind of the label, just like the heavens opened and the angels sang, because they said, okay, we got this now. We're good. We have a Prince song that we can promote, but not as Prince, quote unquote, because he was determined to connect it with a film he was doing at the time. And his character was named Christopher. So he was determined to only credit the song as written by Christopher.
Right. Nobody knew it was Prince.
Nobody knew. Worst secret in all of rock and roll. Yes. And they made sure that was the case. But it served a purpose for them and for us. And it was a fine song. I was like very happy to do it. Very happy to record it. And he was, in his princely way, offering it up as, here, I have the tracks, all you have to do is do the vocals, it's all good. And we're like, thank you, your royal purpleness, but no, we will actually record the tracks and do our version of it, and hopefully you will like it. And he did, which, apparently, hearing from people who worked with him on other tracks, because he wrote for a lot of artists, as you probably know, and he did not like when people did that, and he wanted to control the way a song was produced and recorded and how it came into the world. So he, you know, luckily for us, he liked how we did it.
How did his arrangement differ from what you guys did with it?
It wasn't totally different. There was a couple of different shifts. We did the bridge a little differently. He didn't have the harpsichord thing on his demo.
Oh, okay.
Riff. Yeah. It was a riff that was kind of like that, but it wasn't with that instrumentation. And
who played the harpsichord
on our version? I don't remember, to be honest.
It wasn't one of you four.
It wasn't one of the four of us. No, it wasn't.
So I remember that album coming out, and I probably heard Manic Monday on the radio beforehand. But I remember putting on the record, and like, Manic Monday is this very, you know, polished, produced single. Which I liked. And then Different Like kicks in with like the guitar. And I'm like, okay, here's like
here's the band.
Like, this is what the band sounds like. And I don't remember really ever being that conscious with any record of like how the production of like the single and then the next song can differ from one another. But to me, it's like when that album came out, I was just like, oh, like the songs are In a Different Light and Let It Go. Like those are the ones that pop to me. Yeah. And so I thought, oh, okay, those are like the next singles or whatever. And not that I know.
Good luck.
When you sort of follow a band from when they're less popular and they become more popular, it's sort of this mixed thing where you're happy because you're like, I picked the winner, you know, but also you're just like, oh, now all these other people are on the bandwagon and I'm the original.
They were mine.
I'm a charter member of it.
Yes.
But anyway, I was like happy because you guys were doing well, but I also sort of thought, people should know them because for A Different Light and Let It Go as much as they know them for, you know, If She Knew What She Wants and Walk Like an Egyptian.
Yes. Well, there was definitely, again, politics and money involved. But when we were making those records, the time spent on the production of Manic Monday versus Different Light was, you know, you couldn't even measure them in hours. It was just like Different Light is like, okay, are we in tune? Okay, go. Okay, that's good. Moving on. You know, it was like very much, we're just throwing that one in here, you know, and the same with, you know, I felt that with a lot of the songs that weren't quote unquote singles from the get-go. And I'm sure this happens with a lot of bands, but it was very obvious to me and sonically apparent. I think you noticed it. The thing that you liked about it, that sort of roughness, oh, it sounds like the band, you know, it's like distorted guitars and, you know, a riff and this sort of thing, was probably the very thing that wouldn't make it a single. You know, I don't know. This is how they were thinking at the time. Don't forget, it was the mid-80s.
right. You know, and Debbie told the story about just how, you know, Walk Like an Egyptian, you all had to basically audition to sing one of the three verses. And she felt like she was voted off the island on that one and couldn't play drums on it because they used the drum machine.
Yeah.
So she had this kind of mixed feeling about that song. I mean, were you guys happy that was that was a huge hit, you know? Was that a good thing for you guys?
It was a good thing. It was a mixed blessing because first of all, I didn't think they would release that. It was too weird of a song. I remember talking to my manager and after we put out If She Knew, and he's like, well, what do you think the third single is going to be? And I said, well, if CBS has any balls, they put out Egyptian, but that's never going to happen. You know, because I thought it was so quirky. Unlike Manic Monday, which I felt kind of fit into our world sonically and structurally, Egyptian is completely insane, and God bless Liam Sternberg, you know, just so creative, but so insane. And aside from the vocal audition thing, which was horrific and like, you don't do that to a band, in my opinion, it was kind of fun to make because that rhythm loop that, we're using a drum, an old school Lynn drum machine, you know,
right,
from the 80s, but we also kind of created a rhythm loop. You know, we had David kind of had these weird shakers that he brought back from Mexico or Puerto Rico or someplace. It was like devil heads, or I just remember them being creepy looking, but fun. And trash can lids and, you know, just making noise. And that was actually enjoyable, creating that rhythm loop that we kind of did as a gang. It was like kindergarten, you know, rhythm class, you know, and there were certain aspects of it that I thought were really fun, but it was completely that did not jive with my sense of who the band was. No.
It is a fun song. It's a fun single. Like, I understand why it was a hit. I wasn't like, oh, turn that off. I was like, nah, you know, I enjoyed it, but it didn't, you know, again, being a charter member, you know, there wasn't like, well, this is, you know, people don't get, you know,
not this, my band. This is not my band, right?
It was still my band, but you know, when you played the album live, it all sounded really good, but there was like some stuff that was more on mission than others. And you know, like even like the synths on If She Knew What She Wants sounded like foreign to me on a Bangles record. But then again, so much of the 80s sounded foreign to me at the time. I mean, like, you know, Elvis Costello was putting that stuff on Goodbye Cruel World. And I was like, what?
Come on, dude.
You know, then he pulled it back for, you know, King of America and Blood and Chocolate. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people go back and forth.
No, I'm with you, man. There were a lot of sounds I was not a fan of the chorused guitar that everybody used. We used it very sparingly. I don't remember ever saying, oh, let's use a chorus on that. I just never liked it. I thought it was an overused sound. I was never a huge fan of the gated snare and the
right.
you know it as soon as you hear it, you're like, oh, it's 1986. Some of those sounds are so, you know, so specific to the,
it's a timestamp.
Absolutely.
You know, like there are timestamps from 67, which I tend mm-hmm. to like, you mm-hmm. know, like all the phase shifts and stuff. But yeah, those timestamps from like 84, 85, 86 are just like,
yeah.
I mean, the Prince stuff has that too. Like some Prince
songs,
some Prince songs sound fantastic, and some Prince songs, no offense to Prince, who I think is obviously fantastic, but some of it is just like, oh, it sounds a little
it's
thin.
Just, that moment. Yeah.
Cynthia. Exactly. Yeah.
It's like the ruffled socks with the Mary Janes from it was like the you know, me being put in a kimono for Hero Takes a Fall. It's like the clothes, the ruffles, the, you know, it is that's so identifiable to that moment, which maybe isn't a bad thing. Maybe it's kind of cool. I mean, you think of 1965 fashion, you're going to think of a certain kind of this kind of mini dress and this kind of haircut and this kind of makeup and this, you know, I'm very time specific when it comes to that, those sort of aesthetics. But sonically, I'd like things to be a little more classic in the sense that they can live in any time and place and not be so specific to one.
Right. So within the band, you know, you guys are all on the same page pretty much, you know, in that first EP and, you know, starting off all over the place. How much were you on the same page by the time the whole Different Light album and tour and promotion had played out?
I think you can see it from the album cover, where it's like, let's just go to individual shots because we're never actually going to agree on a band shot. You know, it started to become very individualistic already, you know, and I spent a lot of energy trying to be the diplomat and the glue and to keep this thing together, but it was already sort of shifting.
And do you think that was more from external forces or internal? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know you talked about David Kahn obviously mm-hmm. pushing Susanna as like the front woman when you were a band of, you know, a bunch of front people before
mm-hmm.
then.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how much of a difference that made or whether it was also that your just interests started diverging.
It was definitely both. It was definitely both. I mean, you know, I'm sure the conversations that were happening in the offices of the label were specific to, you know, what's the easiest way to market this group. And, you know, Susanna has the radio friendly voice. And so we're going to go with that. And let's just, you know, that's where we're going. But it also, you know, it was also within the band. I mean, people had their specific ideas and their energies and their opportunistic ways of looking at things and aspirations and ambitions.
Your ambitions were not aligned at that point.
They were not.
What were your ambitions?
My ambitions was keep the freaking band together, you know, really. And to portray us the way I had always envisioned it, which was a band of equals and a band with a voice. And if that voice, not necessarily from one human person, but a voice, a collective voice, i.e. through songwriting and musically, our musical modalities, our music, the sounds, the things that we're referencing, you know, that we'd started so clearly as the Bangs, you know, we knew exactly where we came from and what brought us here and why we were loving what we were loving. And those things started to shift, and that's okay. That's called growth, and that's fine. It just made me sad that we were sort of splintering off into different corners again. And,
right.
and that was definitely encouraged.
Carol Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery and the new beer sponsor of the Pitchfork Music Festival. Now that summer has kicked in, you know what beer really hits the spot? Cold Time, Revolution's premium lager. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a slow, lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. Cold Time is available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans.
Things she's all the seven wonders of the world.
Everything, the third album, produced by David Sigerson. So, so you're out of the David Kahn universe, but there's a lot of co-songwriting on it, but not that much within the band. It's correct. A lot of co-songwriting outside of the band.
Outside of the band. Again, same situation. And I'd even been starting, people were trying to encourage me, you should just, you know, let's just get some songwriting sessions set up with you. And I'm like, yeah, I would like that with my bandmates, but they were not into that. So, and I think with Sue, she just figured out she was going to do better by writing with people outside of the band who were professional hit songwriters. And that was a very savvy move. And I totally get it. It just was not what I wanted for the band. And it's not what, you know, I wanted to do personally, but I was sort of, you know, you should try and write with this person or this person. So I took a bunch of writing sessions and it wasn't my comfort zone. Cause at the time I was mostly a solo writer and or writing with somebody I considered my quote unquote partner, which at that time was Susanna, but she was not interested in doing that anymore. So that was sad to me. That was actually a heartbreak.
You tried to write more with her and you just weren't mm-hmm. able to.
Yeah. It just didn't come together.
Yeah, I'm looking at the like Watching the Sky was when you mm-hmm. co-wrote on that record.
Yeah, which is basically a song that I brought to her and we finished it together, but I wrote 90% of it, which is fine. That happens.
It wasn't you two sitting with your guitars, laughing and like, coming up yeah. with stuff and yeah. all that stuff.
It wasn't.
I mean, the like, Beatles kind of quit doing that too, and they still did yeah, all right. But absolutely. It wasn't like as much collaborating outside of the band like this,
right.
this was.
They didn't do that. They had set up their parameters very clearly, and it's okay to, you know, John's going to bring in a song and it's 99% done. And maybe Paul will like come up with two ideas or whatever, and they're going to grow it as a band, but it's still a Lennon McCartney song.
Right.
And that's how they always did it. They were just, that was just it.
So what was the experience of the Everything album like for you?
It was not a bad experience. And that's mostly because of David, who was just a lovely human and another very intelligent man who knew that he had a sort of a powder keg on his hands in certain ways. Like things were tense. We still had a lot of fun and we were, you know, enjoying the process and we always tracked live at the beginning of the process. It was something that we always did. So we played these songs together as a band live. And then, cause it was the '80s, you'd go through and systematically replace everything, single thing you just recorded. which is completely ridiculous, but that's what we did. But David made everything fun. He was just a lovely person. And I think he got the best record he could have out of us at that time. Because it was like the White Album. We were, you know, we would track together, but then it was time for someone to do their lead vocal. They were there alone with David and the engineers and
When Eternal Flame was brought in, did mm-hmm. you think, oh, here's the big hit?
Yes and no. I thought, here's the big hit for anybody. It just didn't remotely sound like a Bangles song to me. It was obviously a Susanna vehicle, which at the time I was like, we've had enough of that, you know? So yeah, if I was just the savvy business person, I would have said, yeah, let's go. You know, this is going to be great. But again, kudos to David, I think, because he found a way to make that song beautiful and it is lush and it's romantic and it's all these things, but it could have been really corny. And I don't think it is in the end. I think he did a good job, you know, Susanna sang it beautifully. I didn't really want it on the record, to be honest. I didn't think it fit. I thought it was too soloistic and just, you know, I said, like, give it to Whitney Houston. You know, I mean, she'll have a huge hit with it. It could have been anybody would have had a huge hit with it.
Right. So you actually argued to keep it off the record even after it was recorded?
I'm an idiot. No. Before.
Before it was recorded.
Demo. Yeah. No. By the time we made the record, it was like, oh, yeah, I get it.
Well, I could see. I mean, again, it's one of those songs where it's like, okay. it's this undeniable hit single, but it's also like, you know, that's not my Bangles. That's a different Bangles, you know?
It hadn't been for a while, to be honest. So I should have just, you know, at that point, I was sort of just like, to quote ourselves, let it go, you know?
Yeah. At what point did you realize that you were not going to be able to keep the band together?
Not until the very, very end, because I'm a very tenacious / stubborn person. And, it wasn't literally until the meeting that was called that my sister and I thought was about discussing the Australian tour that we had coming up, and that there were strikes going on in Australia. We may have to reschedule that tour, and ticket sales. We had to figure out what we're going to do about all of that. And I thought that's what this meeting was. And I walk into a room, a living room of our new manager, and our entire team is there. Our lawyer is there. Our business manager is there. I'm like, okay, this is very strange. And that's sort of like the nut almost dropped. It was just like, Susanna doesn't want to do this anymore. And neither does Mickey. So it's over.
Peterson sisters cast aside.
Just cast aside.
Is that what it felt like?
Absolutely. We felt like idiots. And we felt like we were completely in the, you know, in the dark about this. And this had been something that had clearly been planned and discussed and arranged and completely without us. Because our manager at that time was very aware and savvy enough to know that, well, he's never going to split up the Peterson sisters. So, and if he just takes Susanna out as a solo artist, well, then there's still three Bangles left and they might reform and start a competition. So we can't have that. So let's just make sure that, you know, Michael, who was also very unhappy, to be honest, in the situation and was ready to make a move herself, he was like, yay, this is easy. I just take these two and these two can stay over there. And, you know, there's no threat there because they're not going to be the Bangles as the Peterson sisters, although we could have been.
Right. It was,
We absolutely could have been. But such a heartbreak and such exhaustion at that point. Everyone was exhausted. So.
What was Michael Steele's, Mickey's issue at that point? Did she want to go solo as well? Or
she did eventually. I don't know that she was thinking along those lines at that moment, although she might have been. I think the evil manager was sort of putting things in her ear that he would represent her, and which of course he did not do. So I think she was just looking for a way out too. She was very unhappy. The last tour was sort of miserable.
What was so miserable about it? You're sort of four buses for four different people sort of thing?
No. We never did the Fleetwood Mac thing. We never, first of all, couldn't afford it. No, we were always in one bus at that point. Did finally have our own rooms. We never toured with like major luxury models. But it was just the stress of feeling like everyone again was just wanting different things and not in a healthy way, and not being able to talk about it out of fear, and not being able to address the issues. And, you know, I mean, it seems so silly. And also you're emotionally and physically exhausted because we toured a lot and we didn't say no to almost anything. And we finally said no to one thing that the label wanted us to do. We finally said no. And they came back and they were like, well, what do you want? What do you need? We're like, well, okay, we fly our boyfriends over first class. You give us this, you give us that. We're, you know, like things we never thought to ask for before. And they were like, okay. you know, it was all around when Debbie was getting married, and, you know, we didn't want to, I don't know, we were exhausted.
Right. And you weren't all just kind of hanging out, having fun, like, you know, when you're on the road or something.
Not a lot. There was some of it still, you know, but no, it felt very fragmented for sure.
So what happened right after that? Like, did you just sort of crawl into a hole for a while, or did you?
Yeah, I wasn't sure I was going to want to play music again. I was heartbroken.
Debbie said that she went like 6 months without like playing any music or listening to music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I did listen to music. I took a break, but then I had some songs that I was writing and finishing writing, and I did some recording with my then fiance. And then within 6 months, he was diagnosed with leukemia. And so everything that was happening before just shifted and became unimportant. And I went to Philadelphia with him to be with him while he was getting treatment.
Oh, wow. Is he still with us? I should know that, but I don't know.
He's not. He died about a year after he was diagnosed. So he died in June of 91. Yeah. But so my obviously priorities took over at that point, and there were more important things in life than being in a band at that
right.
time.
Yeah. No. Like they say in Spinal Tap, too much fucking perspective.
Too much fucking perspective. But, absolutely.
And Continental Drifters started in early 90s, like not
right
long after
that.
Yeah.
Kind of leapfrogged from That's why I always say that they saved my life, because jumping into the Continental Drifters, and that was just that was a offshoot of working with Susan Cowsill, who was my best friend through this period of time. And she and I started writing songs together and started singing together, and really enjoying that experience. Again, singing with somebody who it felt like we had what I call the sibling blend, you know, it was almost like singing with a blood relative, you know, and which I just love that so much. And so that was really restorative for me. And that was 91, you know, it was, again, this Bam 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 happened. And she and I ran into sort of the Continental Drifters through our friend Mark Walton, who was in the Drifters and owned Uncle Studios, where we were rehearsing. We rehearsed with the Psycho Sisters. We were auditioning band members, including her brother, John, weirdly.
Speaking of family, yes.
Family. And we just, I remember Susan and I sat there, watched these guys play. And then, oh my God, we were just completely enamored / blown away / wondering how we could get them all to stop smoking, because they were going to be our band. Like, that's some hubris, but that didn't happen. But what did happen is that we started singing with them, and eventually kind of got absorbed.
So you really thought, you originally thought they were just gonna be the Psycho Sisters backing band.
Yeah, we want to use them as a Psycho Sisters band. They write great, they're amazing, they play great, you know. I know, like, right, that's some chutzpah.
I saw you guys at South by Southwest, and I think the first one I went to was 91, so it would have been there like 91, 92, and I don't know if it was like one of your debut performances, but I remember going with Greg Kot, the Tribune rock critic, and like, oh, we got to go see the Continental Drifters, because, you know, Vicki Peterson of the Bengals and Peter Holsapple of the DBs, and I was a big DBs fan too. There's another one of my bands who they didn't quite get as huge, but I was always rooting for them too, and.
Absolutely.
You know, and other people who I'd heard of, but, you know, and Susan Cowsill, who I heard of, but I didn't really know the Cowsills that well, but sure. I thought that sounds cool. Yeah. And they were like all these people on this little club stage, and then you're taking turns. Everyone had songs. I'm just like, all right, let's have another Vicky song. Let's have another Peter song. And you had to sort of wait your turn. And, you know, they were all good songs, but it's like, you know, you had to, you know, you come into it with, you know, history with some of them.
Your favorites. Oh, man, but it was such a great experience. And that experience for me never really changed. It was always wonderful. And the band changed enormously from 91 to 2001, 2003. I mean, we are still Drifters. To this day, we're working on there's a book being written. There's a tribute record being made. There's a best of coming out next year.
Reunion tour, the big reunion tour.
Probably, yeah, we'll do something like that next year for sure.
You got to herd all those cats.
I know. And there's a lot of cats to herd.
Yeah. You should get everyone who was ever a Continental Drifter to be part of it.
Well, we did that actually in what was it, 2015, 16? We had a big reunion and we had every single Drifter on stage. And you'll see the picture on our website, a Continental Drifter. We had Gary Eaton, we had Danny Magoo, we had Ray Ganishow, everybody. And all the originals, and then all the latecomers and the Psycho Sisters.
was that a refreshing experience for you to be part of a group of musicians, like a real collective where the spotlight's not on anyone, you know, it's seemingly not ego driven. You're just an ensemble.
It was, like I said, it was life-saving, because I really wasn't sure I wanted to be involved in music again or still. And the Drifters was exactly what I needed, because it was completely a collective. And I didn't have a starring role, really. And I was just kind of the auxiliary guitar player to start out. And, there wasn't a lot of responsibility, and, but there was a whole lot of camaraderie and fun, lots of fun.
No, I had a great spirit about it. I remember, again, seeing a bunch of those shows. I had the self-titled debut, I have Vermillion. It was great. And was there ever a point where you were either approached or you thought, you know what, I'm just going to do the Vicki Peterson solo album?
No, not yet. it's sort of been popping in my head recently, but I'm very involved in this project I'm doing with John right now. So even that's kind of good, putting things aside, but I am starting to write more with that in my head. But I no, I just didn't. And again, I'm sure it's just part of my personality or something. I really enjoy performing. I really enjoy songwriting. Our year here in Brooklyn has been full of opportunities to be just a singer, which is something that I didn't get enough of in my lifetime before. Just getting invited to come up and sing a Dusty Springfield song, come sing a, you know, Dionne Warwick song, come sing, you know, just stuff I would never think of attacking. And I'm going to sing an Alanis Morissette song next week. You know, it's just like these things we never got to do.
Were you singing an Alanis Morissette song?
At a karaoke bar here in Brooklyn called Sid Gold's Request Room. We're doing an Alanis birthday celebration, and it's basically karaoke. It's just piano karaoke.
Wow.
But a bunch of us are getting together to lay homage at the feet of Miss Morissette.
What night is that?
That's the 4th. John and I are playing some shows in New York, playing on the 26th at that same little karaoke bar. We're playing at a very cool listening room in Hoboken in July. We're doing some stuff.
So you do a lot of making music with family, and Susan mm-hmm. now is family because you married her brother. You know, your drummer was your sister, and now your drummer's your husband.
Yes.
Is that part of sort of the I don't know, the allure of music for you, is just making it with people who you're really close with?
Yes, I think it has to be. I mean, other than writing songs, which is most comfortably for me a solo enterprise. But as far as creating the music and turning that song into something that someone might actually want to listen to, I want friends and help with that. And I especially now will only do that with people I like and enjoy. That's just not going to ever be an option again. Like John and I were saying to somebody earlier today, I was on the phone with Mickey Steele actually earlier, and we were saying, we only play with people we like, and that's just only nice people allowed. And that's just how it is. It's be nice or leave. It's the New Orleans motto, be nice or leave.
So you and Susan Castle have co-written some songs. Is that more like one of you finishing the other one's song, or is that actually sort of the old fashioned?
Mostly in a room, together. Yeah. Or on a mountaintop or somewhere. Yeah. Somewhere strange, but the songs that we've written together were definitely collaborated that way.
And you feel like you have that kind of, again, sisterly sort of harmony thing going on with her too.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Again, you described it like that before you even related to her, but it's like that family feeling. That's what makes it sound great.
I know. It was strange because the first time we sang together, she said, wow, you sound like I'm singing with my brother Barry. And so then, interestingly enough, John and I, the project that we're working on right now is we made a record, in honor of and tribute to Bill and Barry Cowsill. And it's a cover record of their songs. And some of which have been recorded before with Bill's band in Canada, but some of which have not been ever recorded before. And some of Barry's songs. And I tended to choose the Barry songs for whatever reason to sing. It was a connection that I had with him.
So having, you know, done the Continental Drifters and done all the singing and writing with Susan Castle, like, what was it like going back to being with the Bangles for, you know, you had the Austin Powers song and then you had Doll Revolution mm-hmm. 2003. Like, what did it take to get to the point where you could make music with them again?
For me, it was actually years. I was kind of kicking and screaming to come back. And Susanna was the one who was calling every few months. She would call and say, hey, we got this offer to do this thing. Or would you be at all interested in coming back? And I was always saying, I'm not interested in doing an 80s package tour. I'm not interested in doing anything that's just a revisionist nostalgia thing, because I'm having too much fun making actual real-time music in New Orleans with my friends. So, and then plus I think at one point I said, you couldn't afford to buy the therapy I would need to go back and sing Walk on Egyptian. Cause that's how I felt at the time. I felt like so removed from anything I could possibly do. It's funny how time changes, But what I was open to was like, but if you want to write some new music and maybe record, and I said, I'd be open to that. And so that took a while to happen. And then the Austin Powers thing was the opportunity that made that work. And that's what started the ball rolling, actually, with us recording together. And then we were invited to be part of a celebration of the Beatles at Hollywood Bowl, the sort of their 1964 concert. And they were having a reunion, not a reunion, an anniversary. And Sir George Martin was going to lead the symphony, the Hollywood Bowl Philharmonic. And we were invited to come sing. And I don't know about you, but I'm not going to say no to something like that. So that was our first time on stage together, which is in 1999, I believe, with Mickey as well. So all four of us.
Felt good.
It was great. It was fantastic. Yeah. And then we went from there to making another record.
Did you have to have any sort of group, I don't know if I want to call it group therapy, but some sort of group meeting where you sat down and said, now about that last meeting we had and the way we left things, we need to talk about this before we move forward.
We did do that. Yes, absolutely. We did. We sat down and said, we got to be open with each other. And if any one of us feels really strongly about something, especially about not doing something, then the others need to listen to her. Because we want to make sure no one's going to be forced to do something they were not comfortable with. And that was sort of we did set up some guardrails in a way, some guidelines of how to function as a group, which I think was a good idea. And that worked for the most part. Until it didn't, but yeah.
And you did Doll Revolution with Brad Wood, who mm-hmm. I knew from Chicago before he moved out to the Valley. And I would imagine he is not the sort of tell you what to do sort of producer. So yeah. I would think that was a total different experience for you making that album.
Yeah, it felt like a collaboration for sure with Brad, and just a wonderful personality, very easygoing, but also very smart and very musical and very, always the wrong word, but I can't think of quite another word to substitute for like organic. I mean, he was not trying to force anything upon us that didn't feel natural to us, in any way. So yeah, he was great. That was fun.
Did you feel like there was more of the sort of collaboration among you on that album too, in terms of songwriting and everything else?
Yeah. So I went and making the songs come to fruition and having and growing them and, you know, playing with them. And there was a sense of playfulness.
So you had that album and then you had Sweetheart of the Sun 8 years later. So that's 2011. Were you thinking at the time, oh, we'll just sort of do one of these every once in a while? Or did you think, oh, we're going to get back on that, you know, album every couple of years, sort of album tour, sort of dynamic that we sort of interrupted, you know, many years earlier?
there was not a lot of political will for that sort of treadmill thing to start up again. That feeling of like, you know, spend 3 months making a record, then spend, you know, 18 months promoting it, and then 3 weeks later starting another record, and then spend, you know, there were families and kids and lives involved at this point, and nobody wanted that. So it was really just, let's make this record. And it, you know, it wasn't easy to get that first record out. I mean, we financed it ourselves. We played a bunch of shows, took that money, made the record, you know, tried to find a partner, sort of found the right partner, label partner to put it out, but it was still everything was a little sketchy. And, you know, the business was changing so rapidly at that point in the early 21st century that we were coming up against some of those changes in a difficult way, to be honest. And so it was a little rough. And then we toured, but we weren't going to tour like we toured. We weren't going to do 12-week tours. It just wasn't going to, that was not in the cards for anybody really. So those years went by, those 8 years in between the records went by very quickly. And we did sporadic touring in that time. Everyone had other projects that they were doing. And Debbie was involved with, you know, she's still like young kids. You know, Susanna was doing solo stuff. And so when we came together to work on Sweetheart of the Sun. It was just another, another opportune moment where Suzanne had been working with Matthew. We all knew and loved Matthew from other, you know, previous interactions with him. And so that's where we started making that one. And then we basically finished it in all our home studios between right. Suzanne's and mine.
You were at Matthew Sweet's house for a while, right? Like he had a home studio.
Everything, all the early tracking was done at Matthew's home.
And I think the credit on it is produced by the Bangles, like with Matthew Sweet, but it's clear that you guys are producing it and he's there, but he's not calling the shots on it. You guys.
Well, it depends on who, where you, I've also seen it produced by Matthew Sweet. So, you know, like it was a co-production. I mean, he was leading the charge sonically. He was manning the desk in the early days, but then we took it and it took it to Sue's house, did a lot of the vocals there. I took it to my house. I did guitars and then I engineered my own sessions there, did vocals at my house, you know, so it was a group effort, but it was sporadic.
Did you like that process?
Didn't mind it because I was just getting to know, I was starting to really enjoy recording and engineering on my own, actually. I felt that very liberating.
And then the last thing you recorded together was that 3x4 where you're like covering songs by the 3 o'clock and Dream Syndicate. That's what you always say. Anything else that's going to get you guys back in the studio together or on stage together?
I don't know. I mean, we have some things coming up next year. We have a biography coming out first of the year, working on a documentary, it's time to come together. So I'm not sure where that's at the moment, but these things are all in play right now. I never say never anymore. Cause I said never and I was wrong. So I wised up on that one. And so I'm open to opportunities.
Would you like it?
It depends. It depends on what it was. Probably in a limited way, I think it would be really fun to play some of those songs again, but I'm really enjoying what I'm doing right now with John. And right now that's my focus.
Do you feel like your musical taste has changed over the years? And, you know, do you sort of grow in ways where, like, again, when you're like young and you have the same records as your bandmates and friends. And then later it's like, oh, these decades have passed and you've been listening to this stuff and they've been listening to that stuff and you're playing different stuff and writing different stuff. Like, does everything just kind of diverge naturally to some extent?
I'm sure it does for most people. I think it should, you know, it's like, I'm just not going to be that guy who still listens to the same, you know, 12 records I had when I was 17. I, like Debbie, went through a period of time, actually even longer, where I just wasn't listening to a lot of music at all. And so I have some catching up to do, even in the 21st century pop and rock and stuff. So I've been listening to more of that recently, more quote unquote contemporary music, and just kind of out of curiosity, like, is what's going to grab me and what isn't going to grab me now.
And so, when you write songs now, do you write songs because you think, okay, I need to sit down and write a song, or will you just like be walking somewhere and you'll think, oh, there's an idea, I got to pursue that?
Yes. Again,
another all the above answer.
Same answer. I've spoken to students before about songwriting and I would say, you have to have the window open. The window has to be open because you have to be receiving the creative impulse, spirit, however you want to look at it, the ghosts, the angels, and you have to be open to it, because when I'm not, it just doesn't show up. But when I am, it tends to show up, and it's a muscle. So you need to rehearse it. You need to exercise it. But yeah, but then you also have to sit down and just apply the effort.
So you still do that? Like, you still make a point of doing it?
Yeah. Yeah. And more and more recently, actually.
At some point, was it in the 90s, you toured with the Go-Go's, you were filling in for Charlotte Caffey?
Yeah, 95.
Yeah, so like, what was it like stepping into another band's dynamic, and what did you sort of observe about them that reminded you of things and also seemed like totally different from anything you'd experienced?
Yeah, it was fascinating, actually, because there was the sense of liberation because it wasn't my band. So I wasn't responsible for ticket sales or anything that happened. You know, I just was there to do a job, which was to play these parts. And I knew all of them. We met, obviously, over the years several times. Charlotte is a friend. Kathy and I had interactions and everything. So I knew them all, which I'd sung on Belinda's records, two of Belinda's records, solo records, and done TV with her too. So these were people I knew, and it was, so it was very comfortable for me that way, but it was also very interesting to watch the dynamics of another group and another group of people who have known each other a long, long, long time and have been through a lot and have been, you know, more ruthless with each other than the Bangles ever were with each other. And yet we're able to come together and work as a unit, which I thought was really admirable. And it was really fun. It was fun to play parts that I don't normally play. And, you know, I get Charlotte and what she plays on guitar and hung out with Jane. Actually, was just emailing with Jane because she's going to be involved in a charity we're doing in January called Joey's Song. Jane Weed and Debbie Peterson and Vicki Peterson will be on stage together in January in Minneapolis.
Cool.
I'm sorry, in Madison. Madison.
That's even closer.
I know, but there you go. It is. You should come.
What did you learn about the Go-Go's that you didn't know before you were actually a Go-Go for a little bit?
I can't tell you.
Can't tell me, meaning there's something, but you just don't want to say it, or that
yes.
You really don't know.
There's things I don't want to say.
Oh, okay, that's fine. That's fair enough. That's fair enough. This isn't about the Go-Go's anyway, but I just thought it was interesting that you'd sort of moonlighted in that band.
Yes. So. It was really interesting. I felt like, no, I just need to be in L7 and Belly and I'm good to go. I've been in most of the cool in Hole.
you got to join Fanny now and just do the Fanny, whole historical thing.
I have joined Fanny. Well, we sang on the Fanny record, the new Fanny record.
All right. If you had to choose three Bangles songs that are like the representative Bangles songs, what would they be?
Hero Takes a Fall, Dover Beach, and Annalee, Sweetheart of the Sun.
Oh, nice. That's a good one. I was just listening to that record. I really enjoy it.
It was because, again, it was something that grew out of a collective passion that we had for the whole history of Laurel Canyon and Carole King and Tony Stern and just that whole time and feel. And I think we kind of did a nice job of conjuring that.
It's a good one. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much,
Vicki. All right, bye. Okay. That's it for episode 138 of Carole Pop. Thanks so much to Vicki Peterson for making such indelible music and for helping us see it in a different light. She is on Instagram at Vicki Peterson Official and Twitter X at Vicki Bangle. Aside from all the Bangles albums being available, you can listen to and buy the Psycho Sisters album Up on the Chair, Beatrice on Bandcamp. And seek out the Action Skulls album Angel Here as well. Carole Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who also is more than meets the eye. For a mere $24, you can become a Carole Pop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at carolepop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carole Pop on Twitter X and Instagram at Carole Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carole Pop conversation. Thanks.